This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 1936, 18-year-old Marty Glickman was one of the fastest sprinters in the country, earning him a spot on the U.S. Olympic team and a trip to the Berlin Games.
I'll never forget walking into the stadium, marching in along with my American teammates in the opening day parade.
There was Hitler on the podium with his entourage of Goering and Goebbels and Hess and Himmler and all those people. And we kind of looking up at him, and he looking down at us very sternly. And you could hear the comment run through our ranks as we walked in together. He looks just like Charlie Chaplin.
Marty Glickman may have been among the fastest runners in the country, but one thing stopped him in his tracks. On the day he was to make his Olympic debut, he and a fellow Jewish teammate were dropped from the 400-meter relay. While that story is not widely known, Marty Glickman's voice became very familiar to sports fans, particularly in New York, where he became a broadcast legend, calling games for the New York Knicks, Giants, and Jets during a 56-year career. Marty Glickman is the subject of a new HBO documentary written, produced, and directed by James Friedman. Glickman is now airing on HBO and is making its New Hampshire premiere this Sunday at Cinemagic Merrimack as part of the New Hampshire Jewish Film Festival. And the filmmaker James Friedman is on the line with us. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Virginia.
Now, you have been primarily a writer and producer. Why this subject for your first documentary?
When I was 17, I used to work for Marty Glickman. I'd go in. My brother produced his radio show in New York. And one day I went in with him, and I'm sitting in the control room, and my brother told Marty he had to go into the Army Reserves and Marty would need to find another producer. Without missing a beat, Marty pointed directly at me and said, "Jimmy can do it." And I literally turned around expecting to see another kid named Jimmy sitting there. There wasn't. And for the rest of that year, I produced his show. He taught me how to get the scores off the wire, how to write them up, how to schedule commercials, screen calls. Marty never treated me like some high school kid. He always treated me as his producer, and it gave me a professional confidence I have to this very day.
Well, you don't get jobs like that anymore, I guess.
No.
But you were aware at that time he was a broadcasting giant. Did you know anything about his past as an Olympic athlete?
No, I was so naive. I only knew about him as the New York Giant football announcer and some other things he did. And most people in New York knew him as only that because Marty never talked about the Olympics unless he was asked about it every 4 years when the Olympics occurred. And he also didn't talk about what a great athlete he was on the air like many sport broadcasters do. So people, you know, he's from that generation. It wasn't considered proper to, you know, talk about yourself. It was almost as if it was considered bragging. So people really only knew him from the air.
Well, let's set the scene as you do in the film. It's 1936. Marty Glickman is 18, Jewish, from the Bronx, attending Syracuse University. One of the best sprinters in the country, qualifies for the Olympics in the 400-meter relay. Many in the U.S. at the time were calling for a boycott of the 1936 Olympics. Was Marty concerned about going to Berlin?
Marty's opinion was very complicated, as were many Jewish athletes. And a lot of it had to do with the congregations that the Jewish athletes belonged to and what the rabbi tended to believe in. But Marty did not favor a boycott. Marty favored going to Berlin to show the world and Germans that a Jew could be just as good as any other athlete, perhaps even better. And that was his attitude going there.
The games begin. Jesse Owens wins 3 gold medals. How did the Nazi regime respond to that?
Well, they actually called the American black athletes who were dominating the track and field events, which were the marquee events of the Olympics. They actually called them black auxiliaries. And Joseph Goebbels, the Nazi minister of propaganda, referred to them as more monkey-like than human. And they felt it was a shame on the white race that, one, they were beaten by these black, great American black athletes, and two, that the white American Olympic officials even allowed them to compete.
Well, on the day of the 400-meter relay, Marty Glickman gets called into a meeting. Set this up for us. Who's at the meeting?
It was actually – there were two Jewish runners on the track team, Marty and Sam Stoller, and they were celebrating Sam Stoller's 21st birthday when the head track coach, Lawson Robertson, and the assistant head track coach, Dean Cromwell of USC, came into the meeting and announced that they had heard rumors that the Germans were hiding their best sprinters to upset the American team in the 400-meter relay. And consequently – Marty Glickman and Sam Stoller were going to be dropped from the relay team and replaced by Jesse Owens and Ralph Metcalf, who had already run in the Olympics and gotten Jesse three golds and Metcalf had gotten a silver. Now, this is an absurd argument because you can't have world-class sprinters unless they've run in races and had world-class times. So it was a ridiculous lie. The truth is the American team was favored to win this race going away. They won by 15 yards. So Lou Zamperini, one of the track runner, great track and field U.S. athletes in the film, says, you know, if Glickman and Stoller had run, we probably would have won by 14 yards. It was that absurd a situation. And basically, there are rumors that Avery Brundage, the head of the American Olympic Committee, was placating Adolf Hitler. Brundage was proven to be a Nazi sympathizer. He, along with Dean Cromwell, both later became members of America First, which did not want the U.S. to enter World War II. Mm. And so many people believe that that is what happened. Marty certainly believed that.
Well, let's hear a clip from your film, Glickman, where Marty Glickman remembers his response to this meeting.
We were shocked. Coach, you know, we're the only two Jews on the track team, Sam and I. We'll worry about that later, said Dean Cromwell. Sam was completely stunned. He didn't say a word in the meeting. I'm a brash 18-year-old kid, and I said, Coach, no matter who runs, we're going to win this race by 15 yards. At which point, Jesse spoke up and said, I've won my three gold medals. I'm tired. I've had it. Let Marty and Sam run. They deserve it. And Cromwell pointed his finger at him and said, you'll do as you're told. And in those days, black athletes did as they were told.
That is a clip from Glickman. It is a new documentary written, produced, and directed by James Friedman, who we're speaking with right now. It's about Marty Glickman, who is a legendary broadcaster, but with a very interesting past as a would-be Olympic athlete dropped from the 1936 Games because he was Jewish. James Friedman, the 1936 Olympics are remembered as this showcase or would-be showcase for the Nazis. You know, we have Leni Riefenstahl's idyllic photographs of these Aryan athletes. But is the story of Marty Glickman and Sam Stoller evidence of anti-Semitism in our own country?
Well, you know, this is a time when, Marty went to train for the Olympic trials. He was going to meet his friend Eddie O'Sullivan at the New York Athletic Club, and he shows up at the club, and the doorman says, recognized him because Marty was a famous sprinter in New York, and he said, Marty, what are you doing here? And he says, I'm meeting my buddy, Eddie O'Sullivan. He's going to help me train for the Olympic tryouts. And the doorman says, I'm sorry, the locker room's full. And Marty said, well, I just have my little gym bag. I can share Eddie's locker. And the doorman said, he's sorry. And Marty realized on the way home that the club was restricted. They didn't allow Jews at the New York Athletic Club. Hmm. And, you know, it was also an era he played football with a black teammate, Wilmuth Siddhat Singh, who was not allowed to play football south of the Mason-Dixon line against white football players. It was a very different era.
A pretty embarrassing chapter in American history. Has this been publicly acknowledged?
Yes. Marty, many years later, I think it was close to 60 years later, the head of the Olympic Committee at that time, Bill Hibble, gave Marty Glickman and posthumously Sam Stoller the Douglas MacArthur Award, which more or less was an apology for what happened. But, you know, that's an apology that's coming 60 some odd years later. You know, it's you've lived a lifetime with that. I don't really know what that meant to Marty Glickman, but I do give Bill Hibble credit for doing that.
And Marty Glickman sort of has his another lifetime of his own. He returns to Syracuse, plays pro football for a bit, and became a beloved sports broadcaster. Tell us a little bit about his style. Actually, let's hear a little bit first.
Vince Barilla has it in the corner, moves out along the sideline, over to Al McGuire at the top of the key. He drives, pulls up, jumps, and he hits.
As I saw it, I said it, and also felt it. And the feeling of it is just as important as the description of it. And you use the right phraseology. Nothing fancy. A dribble is a dribble, is a phrase they use now. He puts it on the floor. Well, for me, putting it on the floor means taking the basketball and putting it on the floor. He dribbles right-handed along the right sideline. Now you see it, right-handed dribble along the right sideline.
Before the television age, Marty Glickman was the filter, this pair of eyes for so many sports fans, and actually developed his own lexicon describing action on the court and field. What are some of the Martyisms that stick out for you?
Well, what people have to understand is Marty was literally a pioneer of sports broadcasting. He created basketball terminology 101. I mean, all the terms sportscasters are using today, doing a basketball game, the key, the lane, the midcourt stripe, and Marty's most famous one, swish. He also gave viewers, listeners, the geography of the court. Prior to Marty, as incredible as this seems, a broadcast sounded like this. You know, Jones passes to Smith, Smith passes to Friedman shoots. You didn't know where the players were on the court. Marty gave a geography to it. So it would be Smith dribbles up along the left baseline, throws a bounce pass to the top of the key to Jones. Jones throws a behind-the-back pass to the right corner to Friedman, who shoots and scores, swish. You saw the game. So it was revolutionary. And people used to say, you know, this is the era really before television. So the only way to experience sports for many New Yorkers was through Marty Glickman, who said he gave a word's eye picture. And people would say, did you see the game? He said, yeah, I saw it on radio with Marty.
Well, he's a groundbreaking sportscaster, but you also create a portrait of a humble man, a man with great gifts for interpreting how other people lived, I think. And when he retired, he'd already called 1,000 football games, 3,000 basketball games, 15,000 horse races. He's in the Basketball Hall of Fame, New York Sports Hall of Fame, Sportscasters Hall of Fame. Do you think he ever got over that experience in the 1936 Olympics?
No. When people would ask him about it, the hair on the back of his neck would come up a little bit. He would be, I think this was something that troubled him, and I think he put it so beneath the surface that he didn't realize until he went back to Berlin 50 years later, and all of this anger, he went back to was walking on the track where he should have run. And keep in mind, the Olympics in 1936 were followed by World War II, so there were no Olympics in 40 and 44. So Marty Glickman never got a chance to win his gold medal. His own daughter didn't know his story. One day, she was a teenager, and she was watching a documentary on Jesse Owens, and they referred to Marty and Sam Stoller's a story of being dropped from the relay team. And she waited for her dad to come home, and he came home, and she said, "Dad, is this all true? You've never told me this." And he said, "Come with me." And he took her upstairs, and he went to the bottom drawer of his dresser, and underneath some sweaters, he pulled out his Olympic uniform. And Nancy, his daughter, said to him, You know, when you're gone one day, that's what I want." And Nancy brought that uniform out to L.A. when I interviewed her, and I literally got chills touching it. It was very bittersweet. But I don't think he ever got over that. It didn't stop him from having an incredible career and a wonderful life. And I think that injustice, you know, allowed him to really help many other people in their lives to make sure that never happened to anyone else.
Wow, just chilling. Let's hear it from Marty Glickman himself, visiting the Olympic Stadium back in 1985.
"And suddenly, a wave of anger engulfed me. I began to curse out loud, yelling at the individuals now all dead, like Robinson and Cromwell and Brundage and all. I was actually dizzy, feeling such rage that I thought I was going to pass out. How those no-good sons of bitches could have kept an 18-year-old kid from competing in those games so long ago. And it wasn't as though it was me who was the 18-year-old kid, but how could any grown person keep a kid from competing in the games when it was his ambition to do just that?
Marty Glickman, 49 years after being pulled out of the 1936 Olympics. James Friedman, I want to thank you so much for sharing this story.
My pleasure. Thank you, Virginia.
James Friedman, writer, producer, director of the HBO documentary Glickman. It's currently airing on HBO and is making its New Hampshire premiere on Sunday as part of the New Hampshire Jewish Film Festival. There's much more on the showing and a link to watch a trailer of the film itself and to the Twitter feed and website for Glickman. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org. There's more word of mouth coming right after the break. Please stay with us.
Word of mouth!
We're listening to the song Crawdaddies by the band Sister Sparrow and the Dirty Birds. The song is off of Fight, produced by Grammy Award winner and former American Idol judge Randy Jackson. Sister Sparrow and the Dirty Birds bring their hard-hitting, explosive live show to the Press Room in Portsmouth this Saturday, March 29th. Producer Zach Nugent spoke with the band's frontwoman, Arlie Concello, about growing up in a musical family and starting the band with her harmonica-playing brother.
We grew up kind of being a part of that whole scene, and there were always musicians over at the house jamming and stuff. And I started singing with my parents' band when I was like 9. So it's kind of like the family business, you know. I kind of knew from a very early age that this is what I was supposed to do. But when the decision to start a band, I think, you know, came probably after I started writing songs. And then I was like, oh, I could do this. I could write some songs, you know.
Judging by the way you stood at me with your champagne glass full of what I see, it's gonna make it a little bit easier to get along. You got it in you to do this dance, and my deck of you don't work so fast. I'ma teach you how to make it rain. You gotta let it go. You gotta let it go. You gotta let it go. Girl, come on and let it go, yeah.
I'm curious how you navigate writing a song with 8 people giving input and having ideas. How do you guys go about that?
Yeah, it's a lot of cooks in the kitchen. I am the principal songwriter, so basically I bring a pretty finished song to the guys, and I have an idea for what I want it to sound like. And then we do the arranging together. So for me as a songwriter, it's really great to hear my songs interpreted through other people's ears, you know? So that's kind of a fun thing for me to experience. I'm like, oh wow, I wouldn't have thought of it that way.
What time did you get up? Back tonight, baby. I think I would know if you were heading home. You got lost, didn't you? You got tossed, didn't you? You found love on your way home. Ooh, how could you ever?
The Long Way is a song that actually came to me in a dream, which almost never happens. And when that happens, it's like a gift from the universe, yeah. Whomever. So that I remember specifically dreaming this song. And it's a story of somebody cheating, but that didn't actually happen to me. So, so I'm thankful for that.
But now you stepping out, you with her helping.
so sad and lonely. Ooh, got another thing coming to you. Oh, I think you took the long way. Think you took the long way home. I think you took the long way.
That was Arlie Cancello of the band Sister Sparrow and the Dirty Birds speaking with producer Zach Nugent. The eight-piece band is playing at the Press Room in Portsmouth on Saturday, the 29th. For more information on the band and the show, go to wordofmouthradio.org. Bring out everything but the kitchen sink. When Word of Mouth continues, we head to the Tinkering Studio of San Francisco's beloved art and science museum, the Exploratorium. But first, the news.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Well done.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In this disposable digital world we live in, a sea change is underway. Enter the age of the makers. In cities and towns across the country, community makerspaces are popping up, giving the public access to 3D printers, CNC machines, welding equipment, and more. Access to high-tech equipment certainly isn't the only draw. The maker revolution, or tinkering renaissance, is also about community, like-minded creators coming together at the intersection of art, technology, and science. Karen Wilkinson is co-author, along with Mike Petrich, of a new book called The Art of Tinkering. Karen and Mike are also co-directors of the popular Tinkering Studio at San Francisco's renowned Museum of Science, Art, and Human Perception, also known as the Exploratorium. And Karen joins us now from San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. I'm happy to be on the program with you.
What is your definition of tinkering? It's kind of an old school word.
It is kind of an old school word, and it's interesting. We've given now workshops kind of around the world, and not all cultures have a word for, you know, tinkering doesn't mean the same thing in different cultures. To us, it really is this way of going about inquiring about things around you. You're kind of asking questions of the phenomena, of the material. It's part problem solving, part making, part doing, but it's really about kind of propelling yourself past failure and frustration and really just enjoying the pleasure of tinkering with something.
What do you think is behind this resurgence in making and tinkering?
Yeah, well, the maker movement to me is just, it's so exciting to see the growth. It's definitely, as you mentioned, it's in the zeitgeist right now for sure. But I still remember, I guess it's almost 7 years ago now, the first maker fair that was held here in San Mateo. It felt like we were on the edge of something big then, and it just continues to grow. I think it's tapped into something that's deeply human in all of us, a desire to kind of connect with others who share similar interests, but also an appreciation for people doing way out, kind of far out wacky things. And the best part of Maker Faire, I think, is that it gives people a platform to share their work. I think the Tinkering Studio does that too, but Maker Faire, you know, it's this weekend blowout that everybody comes, and where you might get to see those folks at different clubs or organizations in a community, they're all in one place at Maker Faire, so it's really concentrated. So you'll have crafters and hobbyists and enthusiasts, but you'll also have professionals who build robotics, so they're all kind of mashed up together.
Well, let's talk about this book. It pretty much runs the gamut of possible projects. There's a section on making cardboard masks, one using those ubiquitous plastic shopping bags to make fabric. What might you suggest, Karen, as a good beginner project or something maybe to rekindle a childhood passion for tinkering?
I think that's it. You've got it. I think tapping into something that you were interested in once, whether it's way back in childhood or even last month, pick some genre that you want to investigate and really push it. Like, for instance, cameras. I mean, I was really interested in photography as a teenager. In the book, there are people who think about cameras, but in completely bizarre ways. I'll give you an example. Justin Quinnell created a pinhole camera. So that's sticking film into something that's got a tiny little hole, and it'll expose the film. Well, to him, it wasn't just a box with a hole in it. He decided to put the film in his mouth. And the gap between his teeth was the hole. So you get this image developed of him laying in the tub. So you see his feet down at the bottom of the tub and the faucet and his arms and the backside of his teeth.
You did say wacky.
Yep. There's a 9-year-old who sent her Hello Kitty doll up into space and photographed it that way.
Whoa.
There's a guy who flies kites and takes pictures down from kites. It's just, I think the beauty of tinkering is that it really is a celebration of kind of playful invention, at its best.
We're talking about The Art of Tinkering. It's the name of a new book by Karen Wilkinson and Mike Petrich. They are also co-directors of the Tinkering Studio at San Francisco's Exploratorium, so she's seen plenty of interesting projects. The Exploratorium, Tinkering Studio, and this book remind me of the wonder of making things as a child. You know, it's like we were born to it. It is a little more intimidating for an adult to walk into a makerspace, not really knowing what their goal is or what their interest is. And playing is kind of scarier for adults, don't you think? Or do you have to encourage adults to play?
You know, I think, yes, you do have to encourage it more than kids. But I think if we start to see both making and tinkering as a practice, something that we develop, you can't be an expert right in the beginning, but you can start with something that you really connect with. Find something that resonates with you. An example that I love of an adult that sort of turned a hobby into a passion, and now she sells stuff on Etsy, is Emily Stone King. She's a knitter. She took a technique that is really used in making socks and kind of was playing with this idea, well, I can make this, instead of making a toe for a sock, I can make this three-dimensional thing. Well, now she has a store on Etsy called Anitomy. Instead of Anatomy, it's Anitomy. And she creates these dissected frogs and rats and bats and worms that are all made out of yarn. They're all knitted. And they're just beautiful. But to me, so a lot of adults I know how to knit. So it's taking that idea and just seeing how you can push it and how others are pushing it. That's the exciting thing.
Let's talk about some of the tenets of tinkering, some of the encouraging words that you and Mike Petrich have from your observations of tinkerers. Here are a couple. One, put yourself in a messy, noisy, and sometimes dangerous situation. What's the benefit there?
Well, that's your keying in on the kind of put yourself in an area that you're a little bit uncomfortable. There's real payoff there. It might not feel good at first, but I think deep down, we all kind of love doing the things we're kind of not supposed to do sometimes. And I think that's what it's about. As adults, we've sort of trained the natural tinkerer out of us in some cases. It's about reconnecting with those things.
Another one, use familiar materials in unfamiliar ways. Some examples of that.
I'm laughing at this, but the one I really love right now is Danny Scheibel. He has done things with masking tape to me that are absolutely unbelievable. He's developed this technique of rolling and folding it. He calls it tapeogami, but he creates these three-dimensional sculptures. And some of them he slices and they almost look biological, but then he also combines them to make giant lamps and environments, but it's all masking tape.
I'm looking at that right now, and also Patrick Nagatani, he makes tapestries, I guess, out of masking tape.
Yeah, it's that idea of just totally pushing a material. Scott Weaver is also in the book. He's another one who's done extraordinary things with toothpicks. And this is something you talked about connecting with something as you did as a kid. He started this when he was 14, and he's been doing it for almost 38 years now. And he has amassed this kind of 9-foot by 9-foot sculpture of San Francisco. But it does more than that. It lets you roll ping pong balls down and through this sculpture to take different tours of the city.
one interesting thing about this. We're talking about some of the amazing things that people make, but this is not a traditional crafting book. There's no Martha Stewart step-by-step diagram of how to make something with a defined result. You give us ideas. You give us elements. Is that the difference between tinkering and crafting?
Well, it is a distinction that we care a lot about. I'll say that. For us, we really wanted to get people started, but not give them a recipe. Give them enough to get going, but not necessarily determine the next step. We wanted that to come from them. So we sort of present interesting phenomena that people can mess with and give an example of something they can do. But our hope is that each reader who undertakes something like that is going to turn up with something completely different from the next person.
Well, messing with is, I guess, another tenet of the movement. In fact, you have a hackable cover for your book. What does that mean?
Well, this is the one thing. We had never written a book before. So the very first meeting, we said, we really want you to be able to tinker with the book. That was the only thing from the first meeting we continued to keep throughout the year of creating the book. But we decided that we wanted the cover to be hackable somehow. So there were lots of ideas going back and forth, and conductive ink was something that a lot of people in the group were drawn to. So the idea is you've got this ink. So instead of typical ink, the ink is conductive, which means if you put a battery down on it, and then we use LEDs, but you hold the LEDs down onto the surface of the ink as well, it'll light up.
Okay, I'm going to tell you, Karen, I'm trying this right now. Got four little LEDs and a D battery.
And you kind of have to futz with it. An LED is directional, so it only works one way.
Uh-huh. So
if it's not working, flip it over and try the lead in the other on the other side. It definitely takes futzing or tinkering.
Okay, we may have drained our 9-volt battery trying this.
That can happen too. Yeah.
All right, I'm going to have to try that in my tinkering hours. What do you hope somebody is going to get out of reading this book?
I hope they're going to get two things out of the book. One is to be inspired by something that really resonates with them personally, but also to see that they're not alone in this. All of the folks in the book started somewhere. They were beginners. But the interesting thing about everyone in the book, they share this tinkerer's disposition, this kind of insatiable curiosity. And I hope they'll kind of become a part of a larger community of people like that.
Well, thanks for inspiring us today, Karen.
Yeah, thank you.
Karen Wilkinson, co-author, along with Mike Petrich, of a new book called The Art of Tinkering. Karen and Mike are also co-directors of the extremely popular tinkering studio at San Francisco's renowned Exploratorium. To find out more about the book and see a video of some of the tinkerers plying their trades at wordofmouthradio.org, there's also a link to the Portsmouth Makerspace, where you can tinker yourself, and more on the second annual Mini Makers Fair that's scheduled for this summer in Dover, New Hampshire. All of that is at wordofmouthradio.org. Carbon, radium, uranium. At one point in all of our lives, we were expected to know the periodic table. But how on earth did those elements get their names? Well, it turns out in some surprising and dramatic ways. We'll find out more when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The periodic table of the elements has been hailed as a paradigm of scientific organization. But the names of the individual elements featured on the periodic table are not nearly as orderly. Some are named for the places they were discovered. Others date back thousands of years. Still others are the product of misunderstandings, scientific vanity, and other reasons. Joe Hansen is the host and writer behind PBS Digital Studios' It's Okay to Be Smart. And he's here with us to unravel the strange history of how the elements got their names. Hello, Joe.
Hey, Virginia. How's it going?
Just fine. I'm very happy to speak with you today, especially after watching this terrific little video explaining this very subject, and the entire thing rhymed. Let's hear just a little.
This one's from a redstone, and this one's yellow, and one's from a rock named for this Russian fellow. Chromium's compounds have colorful sheens. Bromine stinks and chlorine wafts green.
Now, we're not going to ask you to rhyme during this interview, but let's start with the fact that so many elements do end in "-um." Why is that?
Well, you know, the guys who discovered a lot of these things, and they were mostly men, learned men of the Renaissance era, the Enlightenment era, Victorian age. This is when chemistry took off, and they studied Greek and Latin. They called themselves natural philosophers. So, of course, Greek and Latin being like the pinnacles of human thought, that those classical societies, it was only natural for them to attach those kind of roots to all the words, all these elements that they were taking out of the earth and bubbling up in their labs.
A number of elements are named using Greek or Latin words that relate to its unique properties. So can you explain some of the different ways that scientists use names to describe elements?
Well, yeah, I mean, the biggest question I had was, why not just call these things numbers, right? I mean, they have a certain number of protons, certain number of neutrons, electrons. Like, why not just call carbon number 6? But it turns out that those names can actually tell us a lot more about not only where the element came from, but what they do. So let's take gold. Gold is AU in the symbol, and that comes from the Latin word for dawn, shining dawn, aurum. But then we say the word gold. We don't call it aurum. And that's from an Anglo-Saxon word that means shining yellow. So both of those kind of describe gold, but we sort of give credit to different parts of European culture and that led to that modern chemistry that found gold.
You mentioned in your rhyming video that neon was named by a child. What's the story there?
Well, the discoverer of all the noble gases, that farthest right column on the periodic table, those were some of the last to be found, and he had done the right chemistry to isolate this element. He sat down with his son, and he asked him if he wanted to name it. And he said, well, that's new. We'll just call it the new noble gas, and neon, it means new.
How about Einsteinium? Was that discovered by Einstein or just named after him?
No, yeah, most of the ones that we name after people are named in honor of them. There's a group of people that name the elements called IUPAC today, IUPAC. It's an international conference of chemists, and they sort of make the rules of chemistry, so to speak. And one of those rules is you can't have an element named after you until you're dead, unfortunately. We did have an exception to that with an element called Seaborgium, which was named after a physicist named Seaborg, but that's the only one that didn't follow that rule. Although there is an interesting little naming controversy with the element gallium. We always thought this was named for the country of France, which used to be called Gaul by the Romans. But it turns out this was discovered by a Frenchman named Lecoq. And Lecoq in French means the rooster. And if you took the Latin name of the rooster, it's Gallus. Gallus is the species name. So he might have snuck his own name in there by accident, and we just didn't catch it until now.
Some elements, like promethium, are named for mythical characters. Now, why would scientists turn to that kind of invented cosmology to name scientific elements?
Well, that mythology, you know, some of these visions of Vulcan and the gods creating Earth, well, a lot of these elements came out of that Earth, came out of the deep ground. I think it was only natural that people wondered how they got there. And maybe if they knew some scientific reasons, they didn't mind adding a little bit of story to it. You know, one of my favorites there is the element iron. Well, iron comes from a word called the Anglo-Saxon word isern, which we can trace back to meaning holy metal. And before we had the power to, you know, make iron in foundries and pull it out of the earth, the only source of that came from meteorites. Iron's a really common mineral in rocks that fall from space. So if you picked up a chunk of iron off the ground and you saw it fall from the sky the night before, you'd call it a holy metal, and that's exactly what isern means.
Speaking of space, element 93, Neptunium, that was not always its name. It managed to change. Tell us the story there.
This is the craziest story that I ran into in deciphering the periodic table. So element 92, which is uranium, turns out to be the largest one that we can find in the Earth's crust or anywhere that we look. And with the advent of particle physics, big particle accelerators like CERN, those started in the 1930s. Famous physicist Enrico Fermi was slamming neutrons into heavy elements like uranium, trying to make 93 and above. Well, he thought he did it. He thought he had 93 and 94. And this was the era of Mussolini's rise to power in Italy. He took that to the Italian authorities, and they said, hey, why don't we call this one Mussolinium? But it turned out it had a pretty short half-life, and it decayed very, very quickly, just a matter of minutes or hours. And they thought that might be an insult to Il Duce to say that that his power might be temporary. They did end up giving them Italian names, but those turned out to be incorrect because Fermi didn't, in fact, make element 93 and 94. They gave him the Nobel Prize for it, but the next year they found out he made a mistake. So even Enrico Fermi can make mistakes.
Do you know all of the elements by heart, Joe?
No, that's why they made the table, so we could look them up.
Well, Joe Hansen, host and writer behind PBS's digital studios, It's Okay to Be Smart. Thanks for bringing us through some elemental knowledge today.
You're very welcome. There's 118 awesome stories sitting there.
Yeah, many elements that we did not get to. And you can find about their origins on Joe's rhyming video about the names of the elements. There's a link to watch it at wordofmouthradio.org. Given their diverse origins and multisyllabic names, learning the elements is not easy. Yet chemistry students around the world still have to remember at least a handful of the most important elements on the table. Our producer Taylor Quimby's 10th grade chemistry class was instructed to memorize the first 20 elements. And Taylor still remembers most of them thanks to a mnemonic device that he came up with, putting them to song. Hello, Taylor.
Hey, Virginia. How you doing?
Well, I guess it's not surprising that you would put this to song, given your history. How far can you go, though, given that that class took place back in, what, 2000?
Yeah, it was 2000, and I've still got the first 15 memorized by heart.
Okay, do we get to hear them?
We do. Okay, but I should preface this that I have two really different songs with the elements' names. What happened was I was home studying, and so just as I did this, I started sort of singing to myself the elements' names to a variety of different tunes. And eventually I landed on Carol of the Bells. It's not easy. And unfortunately, it only gets you to 15 before the syllables of the elements start to basically mess it up.
Okay. Well, are you feeling it now? Can you share it?
Hold on. I'm a little nervous. Let me. Okay. Hydrogen, helium, lithium, beryllium, boron, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, fluorine, neon, sodium, magnesium, aluminum, silicon, phosphorus. And then it stops. Because
But bravo.
Well, thank you.
Really impressive.
So that would have gotten me, let's see, what's it? 15 out of 20 is a 75.
Uh-huh.
So not a great grade. So what I did was I ended up coming up with my own melody that I think worked a little better. And it definitely got me, I think, up to like 25 or 30, but I have to admit I still only remember the first 15, so I'm going to cheat a little bit to sing you my own version.
Okay, let's have it.
Oh, and you know what? If you want to, you can snap your fingers because it's very snappable. All right. Hydrogen, helium, lithium, beryllium, boron, carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen, fluorine, and neon, sodium, and magnesium, aluminum, silicon, phosphorus, sulfur, chlorine, and argon, potassium, calcium, scandium, titanium, vanadium, chromium, manganese, and iron, cobalt, and nickel, copper, zinc, and gallium. Okay, we're at 31 at this point.
That's pretty impressive. You took it over the top.
Well, at this point, you can actually use that same rhythm and get up to about 50 before you hit 10. And it just messes the whole thing up. So
I guess the founding namers were not thinking about setting this to song.
Unfortunately, because it would have been so much easier for all the high school students out there who are learning the periodic table.
Well, thanks for sharing it with all of us, Taylor.
Thanks for putting up with my nerves. Ooh.
Producer Taylor Quimby there. If you had a funny method for memorizing the periodic table of the elements, you can share it with us on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. And of course, we accept audio submissions as well.
Hydrogen, helium, then lithium, beryllium, boron, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, fluorine, and neon, then sodium, magnesium, aluminium, silicon, and phosphorus, and sulfur, and chlorine, and argon. And
thank you for joining our radio exploratorium of ideas, music, and other elements today. If you do like what you heard, there is much more to browse through and listen to at wordofmouthradio.org. If you missed any of the show, you can listen to our daily podcast. A simple search for NHPR Word of Mouth on iTunes will get you there. And please, tell a friend where to find us. After all, Word of Mouth is all about sharing ideas. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more Word of Mouth this Saturday at noon on NHPR. Right there enough. The metals are good at conducting heat and electricity, but non-metals are not, and usually have lower densities. But in between the two opposing chemical families are the mental elements that...